It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Lippin reporting. British media say the British Air Force has carried out its first raids on Islamic State militant targets in Syria. The raids happened early Thursday, just hours after British lawmakers approved Prime Minister David Cameron's request to launch the operation. Britain has been bombing Islamic State targets in Iraq for more than a year, but London had refrained from striking the militants in Syria until now. Cameron had urged lawmakers to back the extension of British airstrikes to Syria, where the Islamic State group is based, saying the militants there are plotting more attacks on the West. A shooting attack in the U.S. state of California that left 14 people dead has become the deadliest mass shooting in the United States in the last 3 years. U.S. authorities say as many as three attackers opened fire on a holiday party for municipal employees in the city of San Bernardino on Wednesday. Hours later, police shot and killed two of the suspected assailants in a getaway vehicle in a nearby neighborhood. Here's what local police chief Jared Bergawan said about that incident.
We have multiple officers that were involved in the shooting. We have two suspects that are dead at the scene. One is a male, one is a female. We had one police officer that was wounded. He has injuries that are not considered to be life-threatening, and he is at a local hospital and is expected to be okay.
Authorities have identified one of the suspected assailants as an American citizen, Syed Farouk, a municipal employee of San Bernardino. The motive for the shooting remains unclear, but officials cannot rule out terrorism. The U.S. Council on American-Islamic Relations issued a statement condemning the shooting. You're listening to VOA News. The U.S. military says special forces troops being deployed to combat Islamic State militants in the Middle East will have well-planned targets in both Iraq and Syria. U.S. Army Colonel Steve Warren said Wednesday the U.S. deployment will consist of about 100 troops, including a small group of commandos who will conduct what he called very precise surgical operations. Their primary mission will be to find and capture key Islamic State militants thought to have what one U.S. official described as actionable intelligence. A UN nuclear agency report says Iran made efforts to develop nuclear weapons in the past, although such efforts appear to have ended in 2009. The International Atomic Energy Agency report published by media outlets on Wednesday also said that Iran conducted most of its nuclear weapons work prior to late 2003. The agency's findings were based on intelligence provided by the United States, Israel, and other countries suspicious of Iran's nuclear activities, as well as based on the IAEA's own research and interviews. Iran denies seeking nuclear weapons. Its Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi responded to the IAEA report by saying that Iran considers allegations of its past nuclear weapons research to be a closed matter. The Israeli government called on the international community to continue investigating those allegations. A speech by U.S. Central Bank Chief Janet Yellen about the improving U.S. economy has prompted some experts to say the U.S. Federal Reserve is likely to raise its key interest rate soon. In her speech in Washington on Wednesday, Yellen said she expects the U.S. job market to keep strengthening and U.S. inflation to rise closer to the Fed's 2% target rate that signals a healthy economy.
I anticipate continued economic growth at a moderate pace that will be sufficient to generate additional increases in employment, further reductions in the remaining margins of labor market slack, and a rise in inflation to our 2% objective.
Some economists interpreted those comments as a signal that the Fed will raise the key U.S. interest rate on December 16th. And China has agreed to invest $6.5 billion in South Africa to support the African nation's economy. Chinese and South African officials signed the agreement on Wednesday as Chinese President Xi Jinping began a visit to South Africa and met his counterpart Jacob Zuma in Pretoria. The Bloomberg News Agency says the promised Chinese investment includes $2.5 billion in credit for South African rail and transport operator Transnet. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 3rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon claims it inflicted heavy losses on Boko Haram during a three-day operation.
Let me tell you that not only 100, almost 400 Boko Haram have been neutralized, and indeed more than 900 people were freed from the hostage where they were taken.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's information minister and government spokesman. South Sudan urges Britain to withdraw its travel ban on South Sudan. Zimbabwe's opposition parties commit to fighting for electoral reforms ahead of the 2018 elections. And Chinese President Xi Jinping continues his official visit to South Africa today, Thursday.
There's a number of agreements and deals that are being concluded worth billions and billions of dollars, which we believe will make a contribution towards growing the South African economy.
Klesi Moyela is South Africa's foreign ministry spokesman. Rising sea levels endanger Senegalese islands, and Malawi turns to ethanol fuel cars. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroon's army said Wednesday it killed 100 Boko Haram fighters and freed 900 hostages during three operations last week. The claim, which could not be independently confirmed, comes on the heels of twin suicide attacks on Tuesday on the tourist town of Waza, killing at least six people. But Cameroon Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakari says, in fact, the number of Boko Haram terrorists killed during the operation was about 400. He credited the success to cooperation between Cameroonian Army and the multinational joint task force, which is helping Nigeria fight Boko Haram.
Let me tell you that not only 100, almost 400 Boko Haram have been neutralized, and indeed more than 900 people were freed from the hostage where they were taken. This took place during the fight delivered by our army in full cooperation with Nigeria Army. As you know, the International Joint Task Force is already in action, and it looks surprising after very efficient game plan was put in place by our army with the support of our population, the traditional rulers, the predicator in Islam.
Mr. Minister, this operation, as the reports are suggesting, took place maybe over a three-day period. But we know that Tuesday there was a twin suicide attack in Waza. Is your government making progress, or what is happening now?
Well, what deserves to be brought to your knowledge, that it is almost impossible to prevent such attacks because they used to equip young girls between 10 and 15 to carry explosives, enter into houses, and to blow themselves up. No matter how powerful an army can be, it is almost impossible to prevent such a thing from taking place. What took place yesterday in Waza was that three girls carrying with them explosives. Two of them detonated, one in a house, and the other detonated the explosives as the two military were chasing them down. This is what took place. So in this case, it is almost impossible to say 100% in the future it will not take place for as long as the back of Boko Haram is not broken into pieces.
Minister, 900 hostages were released after this operation, according to your military. What is the identity, or what are the identities of the 900? Are they women, children, or where did they come from?
Yes, indeed. We have to deal with people of all ages, all religions. You see, when Boko Haram arrives somewhere, they collect all the people at their hands. All the people reachable, they take them to their area. If they are women, they will become sex slaves. If they are young ladies, young girls, they will use them as a weapon carrier. And if they are young boys, the same thing. So among the 900 people who were released, you will find people of all age, of all religion, and of all nationality. For the time being, it is impossible a list of the origin of those who were released. But with time, we will be capable of doing it.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information and Government spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Chinese President Xi Jinping continues his state visit to South Africa today, Thursday, where he will attend a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South African officials are quick to point out that this is not President Xi Jinping's first state visit to South Africa, a fact that highlights the importance of the relationship between the two nations. Here's Clayson Monyela, a spokesman for South Africa's foreign ministry. He spoke to VOA News from Pretoria, South Africa's capital, where President Jacob Zuma is hosting the Chinese president.
The state visit by President Xi to South Africa is a very important visit. As you know, he's only been in office for less than 2 years, and already he's visiting South Africa for the second time on a state visit. That's quite unprecedented, and it speaks volumes about the strategic nature of the relationship between South Africa and China.
South Africa, after all, is China's biggest trade partner in Africa. The two nations are also members of the increasingly powerful economic bloc known as BRICS for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Xi comes to South Africa after a day-long visit to neighboring Zimbabwe, where he met with his counterpart, President Robert Mugabe. The two governments signed 10 agreements, including a $1 billion thermal power expansion project, according to Reuters. In South Africa, there is also a lot of money on the table, Monyela says.
There's a number of agreements and deals that are being concluded, worth billions and billions of dollars, which we believe will make a contribution towards growing the South African economy and assist us to deal with the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and eradicating inequality. So it's quite an important state visit.
But China's Commerce Ministry recently admitted that Chinese investments to Africa had fallen by 40% in the first half of this year, a move that some analysts attributed to China's slowing economy. Others, however, say it is more related to Beijing's changing approach to investments overseas. South Africa says they aren't seeing that, though, and that trade between the two countries rose more than twofold from 2009 to 2013. In the coming days, President Xi will meet with other African leaders in Johannesburg for a forum on Africa-China relations. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Sudan's foreign minister is asking the British government to withdraw a travel ban it imposed on South Sudan this week. The United Kingdom Foreign and Commonwealth Office cited insecurity in most parts of South Sudan. Foreign Minister Banama Morau Benjamin says the travel ban hurts the implementation of the August 26 peace agreement.
They should have discussed with us these things before really making any travel ban. All the British citizens who are in South Sudan today, there is no record of any British citizen that has been ever killed in South Sudan. So why issue such a travel ban? In fact, it is discouraging. It is putting an obstacle to the implementation process.
Yes, Mr. Minister, Juba could be safe, but other places are not. There are reports of gunship attacking people in Mundri and Eastern Equatoria State. These gunships are coming from where?
Which place is not safe now in the world? The British Parliament now is arguing their security is threatened. Are we going to issue travel ban to UK, in America, in Europe? We have seen in Paris. Which part of the world is absolutely a paradise? I think that is not fair on the peace process in South Sudan. South Sudan is a country coming out of conflict. So what they should have done is to encourage and point out if there is delay in the implementation. We have already, the chair of JEMA, former President Francis Mohai, is on the ground asking for support so that he can do his job. The President Salva Kiir Mayardit has given complete commitment of the implementation and has gone ahead to encourage other areas. The incidences you get in Equatoria or in Lakes or wherever, these are isolated incidences of individuals, criminal acts.
And that is why the United Kingdom is saying they cannot guarantee the safety of their citizens in a country where there are criminal cases.
No, but the criminal cases are, which country has no criminal cases, including Britain and America, where you are? What happens in New York every day? Do you have a travel ban? The criminal cases happen everywhere. That's why they have judges. That's why they have the police to take care of that. So I think it is not fair on the peace process and on the Republic of South Sudan. We would urge Her Majesty's government to continue to encourage the peace process as they have been doing. I think that is more important than scaring people off. It is actually just discouraging the implementation of the peace agreement.
That was South Sudan Foreign Minister Banama Mara Benjamin speaking from Juba with John Tanza of the U.S. South Sudan in Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, December 3rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Opposition political parties in Zimbabwe yesterday signed an agreement to fight for electoral reforms ahead of the 2018 national elections. Former Prime Minister and Movement for Democratic Change MDC leader Morgan Tsvangirai led the signing of a document dubbed the National Electoral Reforms Agenda, which binds the parties to push President Robert Mugabe's government to effect electoral reforms and create a level playing field ahead of the polls. MDCT spokesman Olbert Gutu played down the absence of majority of the parties.
Nine political parties signed the NERA document that speaks to the electoral reforms that the nine political parties say they would want to see implemented to enable free and fair elections to be held in Zimbabwe in the future. President Richard Morgan Tsvangirai signed the NERA document. There was also the leaders of the following parties who also signed: the African Democratic Party, ADP, Transform Zimbabwe, Freedom Party, ZANU Ndonga, and I understand MDC Ngube. There was this party known as Zimbabweans United for Democracy, Progressive Democrats of Zimbabwe, and the Democratic Assembly for Restoration.
But is this not discouraging, Mr. Gutu, judging from the fact that Zimbabwe has more than 35 opposition political parties, and this issue of electoral reforms is something that the ordinary people would assume that the opposition at least will agree on?
There is really no major problem here. What I see is that this is the beginning, I think, of very exciting things to come.
We understand that Zeki is having a strategic meeting on Friday. Have you been invited, and how significant is this?
Oh, definitely. I can confirm that we, the MDCT, have been invited. And from the document that I have before me here, all the political parties in this country, including even ZANU-PF, they have also been invited.
That was spokesman Olbert Gutu of the Movement for Democratic Change Formation of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. He was speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe program. Senegal's Saloum Delta region is a egregious example of how rising sea levels caused by global warming endanger coastal communities around the world. Zlatika Hoke reports on the damage being caused by sea salt on the Senegalese islands.
Mangrove forests are essential to Senegalese coastal ecosystems. They are protecting swampy areas from erosion, storm surges, and tsunamis. They shield crop fields and help boost fish stocks. But as the sea waters rise, the mangroves get too much salt and perish. Droughts and erratic rainfalls that cause floods have increased salt levels and poisoned freshwater sources, land, and agriculture.
Three or four days after the rain, everything goes white. There are piles of salt. All the crops we sow die. All this is due to the salinity caused by the rising waters of the sea. And when we store valuables in our rooms, rust eats away little by little and eventually destroys them.
Residents of the Diamniadio Island near the edge of the delta used to grow their own rice and vegetables. Now they have to buy the produce they used to grow. When the community lost its rice crops, it turned to fishing for livelihood. But when the mangroves die, they also erase the breeding grounds for fish.
When the sea enters in the river, because you have increasing of salt, it has killed many mangroves. And you know the mangroves are the nurseries of all the seafood.
Illegal overfishing further depleted fish stocks, leaving many people without a source of livelihood.
No conservation.
No mangrove conservation and land salinization led us to turn to immigration. A decrease of resources is what drives young people here to take canoes to reach the Canary Islands.
Those left behind fear losing their homes to the sea.
When the tide is high, the water goes into the kitchen and then gradually the water enters the rooms. My kitchen was rebuilt last year, but even today it's threatened by the rising waters. The high salinity of the seawater eventually breaks down even the cement. After 3 years, the building collapses.
Local activists have started an effort to replant mangroves and control the use of the shrubs for firewood. They're also working with the communities to set up sand barriers, provide water tanks to collect rainwater, and grow table gardens with soil made from peanut shells and other material. Environmentalists hope the plight of the islands will receive due attention at the Paris Climate Summit. Larissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Malawi has rolled out its first batch of ethanol-fueled cars as the government works to transition the country to a cheaper, greener alternative to imported fuel. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
This car and 23 others like it are just normal vehicles, except now they can run on 100% ethanol fuel or gasoline or any mixture of the two in a single tank. The cars called ethanol-driven vehicles or EDVs are the product of a $300,000 government initiative to end Malawi's dependence on imported gasoline. The engines are fitted with a special US-manufactured device to enable fuel flexibility.
This is the conversion kit. It has sensors which determine the proportions of ethanol and petrol passing through, and it will open or close depending on the varying proportions.
Motorists are loving the difference.
It's very efficient because it's a cost-effective fuel, and it's best buy Malawian fuel produced right here in Malawi. And I don't have any problem with it. It works equally as good as petrol, and at least because I can also use petrol, I'm not limited.
Malawi's filling stations currently sell blended fuel, 20% ethanol and 80% gasoline. EDV project facilitators at Preskin Corporation Limited say shifting to 100% ethanol would increase jobs and mean big savings for the government, which currently spends $45 million dollars a month to import fuel.
For example, it can go to facilitate the health sector, it can go to support the education sector, it can go to other sectors which would otherwise demand foreign exchange.
Ethanol is made from plants with a large amount of glucose or starch, like sugarcane or corn. Malawi has just two ethanol factories. Critics say that's not enough to meet demand if filling stations move to 100% ethanol, but the companies say they are ready. Ebo Chanje runs one of them.
We are going to start expanding our factory from 60,000 liters per day, as a matter of fact, next week, to 90,000 liters per day, which is a 50% capacity increase.
For now, Preskin relies largely on molasses from a local subsidiary of Wirovo Group, Africa's biggest sugar producer. But Chanje says the plant has acquired 2,000 hectares of land and is supporting farmers who will grow sugarcane there.
We are hopeful that once we start growing sugarcane, we will be able to build decent houses and find money for school fees, and our lives will be improved.
Malawians are now waiting for the government to set ethanol pump prices, which local producers are proposing be 20% lower than gasoline. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Algeria beat Mali 2-0 before Nigeria and Egypt played to a 2-2 draw. In Group B action at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Mboa, some 70 kilometers southeast of the Senegalese capital Dakar, on Wednesday. Consequently, Algeria and Nigeria have 4 points each, though Algeria head the group with a superior goal difference. Egypt has 2 points, while Mali have no point with one round left to the end of the group fixtures. Elsewhere, Uganda tackle hosts Ethiopia before Rwanda engage Sudan in the semifinals at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Addis Ababa today, Thursday. In basketball, Cameroon's INJS edged Burundi's Berco Stars 61-54 as the Democratic Republic of Congo's INSS outwitted Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority 70-65 at the Africa Women's Club Basketball Championships in Luanda, Angola on Wednesday. Nigeria's First Bank pipped Mozambique's Ferroviario de Maputo 63-60, while the Democratic Republic of Congo's Radi dismissed Angola's Makaluso 62-48. Turning to golf, Britain's defending champion Danny Willett aims to get his season off to a good start at the Nedbank Golf Challenge in Sun City here in South Africa. The four-day contest gets underway today, Thursday.
12 months ago, you know, this week really it all started, and yeah, it's been fantastic. So unfortunately, all good things come to an end, and that season finished. And like I said, yeah, it's now start the 2016 season and try and get off to a good one.
That was Britain's Danny Willett, the Nedbank Golf Challenge champion, speaking in Sun City, South Africa. Staying in Sun City, Charles Schwartzel leads the South African Challenge at the Nedbank Golf Challenge. His confidence is high after some recent victories.
I think whenever you win, you know, it gives you that confidence that you can't practice or you can't get anywhere else. So, you know, as I'm standing here, I feel confident. Like I said, I just feel like I know what I need to do to play well.
That was South African Charles Schwartzel speaking in Sun City, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, December 3rd.
It is most unfortunate that the outgone Nigerian leaders have refused to sign the bill for the physically challenged Nigerians. Consequently, as the world observed the 2015 International Day for People Living with Disabilities, we urge President Muhammadu Buhari to justify the bill by signing it, and he shall never go unblessed. I am Prince John Ushir from Obaniku in Obudu Gato Ranch, Kwazulu-State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Cameroon says its troops have killed 100 Boko Haram militants and freed 900 captives that were held by the Nigerian-based militant group. The defense ministry says soldiers killed the militants and rescued the hostages during an operation last week along the Cameroon-Nigeria border. There has been no independent confirmation of the claim. Meanwhile, officials suspect Boko Haram was behind twin suicide attacks that killed at least four people in far northern Cameroon late Tuesday. The suicide bombers blew themselves up in Waza, a town near the Nigerian border. And that is it for this Thursday, December 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Button in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.